Chapter 3. The deep-sea submersible, Old Gert, hung suspended beneath a large crane that sat on the stern of the British oceanographic vessel Invincible. The seas had calmed enough to launch Old Gert for a scientific probe of the seafloor 5,200 meters below, and her crew were following a tight sequence of safety checks. There was nothing old about the submersible. Her design was the latest state-of-the-art. She was constructed by a British aerospace company within the past year, and was now poised for her maiden test dive to survey the Mendocino Fracture Zone, a great crack in the Pacific Ocean floor extending from the coast of Northern California halfway to Japan. Her exterior was a complete departure from other aerodynamic submersibles. Instead of one cigar-shaped hull with a pregnant pod attached beneath, she had four transparent titanium and polymer-woven spheres connected by circular tunnels that gave her the appearance of a jack from a child's game. One sphere contained a complex array of camera equipment, while another was filled with air and ballast tanks and batteries. The third held the oxygen equipment and electric motors. The fourth sphere, the largest, sat above the other three and housed the crew and controls. Old Gert was built to withstand the immense pressures found at the deepest part of the world's seabeds. Her support systems could keep a crew alive for 48 hours, and she was powered to travel through the black abyss at speeds up to 8 knots. Craig Plunkett, the chief engineer and pilot for Old Gert, signed the last of the checkoff forms. He was a man of 45 or 50, with graying hair combed forward to cover his baldness. His face was ruddy and his eyes a medium brown with a bloodhound droop. He had helped design Old Gert and now treated her as his own private yacht. He pulled on a heavy woolen sweater against the expected chill from the cold bottom water and slipped his feet into a pair of soft fur-lined moccasins. He descended the boarding tunnel and closed the hatch behind him. Then he dropped into the control sphere and engaged the computerized life support systems. Dr. Raul Salazar, the expedition's marine geologist from the University of Mexico, was already in his seat adjusting a bottom sonar penetrating unit. "Ready when you are," said Salazar. He was a small dynamo with a huge mass of black hair, his movements quick, black eyes darting constantly, never staring at any one person or object for more than 2 seconds. Plunkett liked him. Salazar was the kind of man who accumulated his data with a minimum of fuss, made the right decisions without clouding the facts, and was accustomed to engineering a deep-sea probe from more of a business viewpoint than an academic project. Plunkett glanced at the empty seat on the right side of the sphere. "I thought Stacy was on board." "She is," answered Salazar without turning from his console. "She's in the camera sphere making a final check of her video systems." Plunkett bent over the tunnel leading to the camera sphere and found himself staring at a pair of sweat-socked feet. "We're ready to launch," he said. A feminine voice, accompanied by a hollow tone, came back. "Be finished in a sec." Plunkett eased his feet under his control panel and was settling into his low, half-reclining seat when Stacy Fox wiggled her way backwards into the control sphere. Her face was flushed from working nearly upside down. Stacy wasn't what you'd call disturbingly attractive, but she was pretty. Her long, straight blonde hair fell around her face, and she often hurled it back with a brief shake of the head. She was slim, and her shoulders were broad for a woman. The crew could only speculate about her breasts. None had ever seen them, of course, and she always wore loose-fitting sweaters. But occasionally, when she yawned and stretched, her chest gave an indication of firm substance. She looked younger than her 34 years. Her eyebrows were thick, her eyes wide apart, irises reflecting a soft, pale green. The lips above a determined chin easily parted in a bright, even-toothed smile, which was almost constant. Stacy was once a California Beach golden girl, majoring in the photographic arts at the Schoenard Institute in Los Angeles. After graduation, she migrated around the world recording marine life that had never been captured on film. Twice married, twice divorced, with one daughter living with her sister, her presence on board Old Gert to photograph the deep ocean was actually a cover for a more demanding assignment. As soon as she gained her seat on the right side of the sphere, Plunkett signaled an okay. The crane operator nudged the submersible down a slanted ramp through the ship's open stern and gently lowered it into the sea. The chop had died, but the swell still rolled past from 1 to 2 meters high. The crane man timed the entry so Old Gert touched a wave crest and continued into the trough, where she settled and rose in perfect sequence with the swells. The lift cables were electronically released, and several divers made a last-minute check of the exterior. 5 minutes later, the surface controller, a jolly Scot by the name of Jimmy Knox, reported to Plunkett that the sub was cleared for descent. The ballast tanks were flooded, and Old Gert quickly passed under the sparkling sea and began her trip to the bottom. Though Old Gert was the newest submersible off the drawing boards, she still descended by the old, tried-and-true system of filling ballast tanks with seawater. For rising to the surface, variable-sized iron weights were dropped to increase buoyancy, because current pump technology could not overcome the opposing pressures at great depths. To Stacy, the long fall through the vast liquid void came like a hypnotic trance. One by one, the spectral colors from the scattered light on the surface faded until they finally vanished into pure black. Except for their separate control consoles mounted around the inner diameter of the sphere, they had an unobstructed 180-degree view ahead. The transparent polymer with the thin threading of titanium made vision equal to that of the resolution on a large-screen television set. Salazar paid no attention to the blackness or the occasional luminescent fish that swam outside. He was more concerned about what they would find on the bottom. Plunkett monitored the depth and the life support instruments, watching carefully for any bugs as the pressure increased and the temperature dropped with every passing moment. The Invincible carried no backup submersible in case of an emergency. If disaster unexpectedly occurred and they somehow became wedged in rocks or the equipment malfunctioned, preventing Old Gert's return to the surface, they could jettison the control sphere and allow it to sail to the surface like a giant bubble. But it was a complex system never tested under high-pressure conditions. A failure here and they had no hope for rescue, only the certainty of death by suffocation and a lost grave deep in the eternal night of the abyss. A small eel-like fish slithered past, its luminous body giving off flashes of light as though a stream of traffic was passing around a series of curves. The teeth were incredibly long in proportion to its head, and fanged like a Chinese dragon's. Fascinated with the interior light of the submersible, it swam up to the control sphere unafraid and cast a ghostly eye inside. Stacy aimed her battery of still and video cameras and caught it in 7 lenses before it was gone.
"Can you imagine that thing if it was 20 feet long?" she murmured in awe.
"Fortunately, black dragons live in the depths," said Plunkett. "The pressure of deep water prevents them from growing more than several centimeters." Stacy hit the exterior lights, and the blackness was suddenly transformed into a green haze. The void was empty. No life was to be seen. The black dragon was gone. She turned off the lights to conserve the batteries. The humidity rose inside the sphere, and the increasing cold began to seep through the thick walls. Stacy watched the goosebumps rise on her arms. She looked up, clutched her shoulders with her hands, and made a shivering gesture. Plunkett caught the signal and turned on a small heating unit that barely held off the chill. The 2 hours it took to reach the bottom would have passed tediously if everyone hadn't been busy at their own jobs. Plunkett found a comfortable position and watched the sonar monitor and the echo sounder. He also kept a wary eye on the electrical and oxygen level gauges. Salazar kept busy plotting their probe grid once they reached the bottom, while Stacy kept trying to catch the denizens of the deep off guard with her cameras. Plunkett preferred the strains of Johann Strauss for stereo background music, but Stacy insisted on using her New Age music in the cassette player. She claimed it was soothing and less stressful. Salazar called it waterfall music, but went along. Jimmy Knox's voice from The Invincible sounded ghostly as it filtered down on the underwater acoustic telephone. "Bottom in 10 minutes," he announced. "You're closing a bit fast." "Righto," replied Plunkett. "I have it on sonar." Salazar and Stacy turned from their work and stared at the sonar screen. The digital enhancement showed the seabed in contoured 3 dimensions. Plunkett's gaze darted from the screen into the water and back again. He trusted the sonar and computer, but not ahead of his own vision. "Be on your guard," Knox alerted them. "You're dropping alongside the walls of a canyon." "I have it," returned Plunkett. "The cliffs plunge into a wide valley." He reached for a switch and dropped one of the ballast weights to slow the descent. 30 meters from the bottom, he dropped one more, giving the submersible almost perfect neutral buoyancy. Next, he engaged the 3 thrusters mounted on the outer ends of the lower spheres. The bottom slowly materialized through the jade gloom into a broken, uneven slope.
Strange black rock that was folded and twisted into grotesque shapes spread as far as they could see. "We've come down beside a lava flow," said Plunkett. "The edge is about a kilometer ahead. After that, it's another 300-meter drop to the valley floor."
"I copy," replied Knox.
"What are all those wormy rocks?" asked Stacy.
"Pila lava," answered Salazar.
"Made when fiery lava strikes the cold sea. The outer shell cools, forming a tube through which the molten lava keeps flowing." Plunkett kicked in the altitude positioning system that automatically kept the submersible 4 meters above the bottom slope. As they glided across the scarred features of the plateau, they spotted the trails of deep crawlers in scattered pools of silt, perhaps from brittle stars, shrimp, or deep-dwelling sea cucumbers that lurked in the darkness beyond the lights.
"Get ready," said Plunkett. "We're about to head down."
A few minutes after his warning, the bottom dropped away into blackness again, and the sub nosed over and fell deeper, maintaining its distance of 4 meters from the steep drop of the canyon walls.
"I have you at 5360 meters, echoed Knox's voice over the underwater phone.
"Righto. I read the same," replied Plunkett.
"When you reach the valley floor," said Knox, "you'll be on the plain of the fracture zone."
"Stands to reason," Plunkett muttered, his attention focused on his control panel, computer screen, and a video monitor now showing the terrain below old Gert's landing skids.
"There's no bloody place left to go."
12 minutes passed, and then a flat bottom loomed up ahead and the sub leveled out again. Underwater particles swirled by the sphere, driven by a light current like flakes of snow. Ripples of sand stretched in front of the circular lit pattern from the lights. The sand was not empty. Thousands of black objects, roundly shaped like old cannonballs, littered the seabed in a thick layer.
"Manganese nodules," explained Salazar, as though tutoring.
"No one knows exactly how they formed, although it's suspected shark's teeth or whale ear bones may form the nucleus."
"They worth anything?" asked Stacy, activating her camera systems.
"Besides the manganese, they're valued for smaller quantities of cobalt, copper, nickel, and zinc. I'd guess this concentration could run for hundreds of miles across the fracture zone and be worth as high as $8 million a square kilometer."
"Providing you could scoop it up from the surface, 5.5 kilometers away," Plunkett added.
Salazar instructed Plunkett on what direction to explore as old Gert soared silently over the nodule-carpeted sand. Then something gleamed off to their port side. Plunkett banked slightly toward the object.
"What do you see?" asked Salazar, looking up from his instruments.
Stacy peered downward.
"A ball," she exclaimed. "A huge metal ball with strange-looking cleats. I'd guess it to measure 3 meters in diameter."
Plunkett dismissed it. "Must have fallen off a ship."
"Not too long ago, judging from the lack of corrosion," commented Salazar.
Suddenly they sighted a wide strip of clear sand that was totally devoid of nodules. It was as though a giant vacuum cleaner had made a swath through the middle of the field.
"A straight edge," exclaimed Salazar. "There's no such thing as prolonged straight edges on the seafloor."
Stacy stared in astonishment.
"Too perfect, too precise to be anything but man-made."
Plunkett shook his head.
"Impossible, not at this depth. No engineering company in the world has the capability to mine the abyss.
And no geological disturbance I ever heard of could form a clean road across the seabed," stated Salazar firmly.
"Those indentations in the sand that run along the borders look like they might match that huge ball we found."
"Okay," muttered Plunkett skeptically. "What kind of equipment can sweep the bottom this deep?"
"A giant hydraulic dredge that sucks up the nodules through pipes to a barge on the surface," theorized Salazar. "The idea has been tossed around for years."
"So has a manned flight to Mars, but the rocketry to get there has yet to be built. Nor has a monster dredge. I know a lot of people in marine engineering, and I haven't even heard a vague rumor about such a project. No mining operation of this magnitude can be kept secret. It'd take a surface fleet of at least 5 ships and thousands of men working for years. And there is no way they could pull it off without detection by passing ships or satellites."
Stacy looked blankly at Salazar.
"Any way of telling when it happened?"
Salazar shrugged.
"Could have been yesterday, could have been years ago."
"But who then?" Stacy asked in a vague tone. "Who is responsible for such technology?"
No one immediately answered. Their discovery did not fit accepted beliefs. They stared at the empty swath with silent disbelief, a fear of the unknown trickling down their necks. Finally, Plunkett gave an answer that seemed to come distantly from outside the submersible.
"No one on this earth.
No one who is human.